Hello. You're now listening to the Modum Podcast, where we deconstruct, examine, and discuss deeply technical data networking and information technology topics. Sit back and relax while we fire up Dial D and the 9600 baud modem and connect to the Wildcat BBS.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Modum Podcast, your haphazardly put together and inconsistently timed podcast that comes out really whenever we feel like doing it. So today we happen to feel like doing it, and we've got a really, really great guest, Andre Tunk, who you may know from BGPmon fame, which is how I learned of him, has a new little interesting product that we're going to go deep on here. How are you doing today, Andre?
I'm great. Thanks for having me. And great to see you again. It's been
a long time. It has been a very long time, actually. Now that you mention it, I'm recalling that it has been quite some time. And with me, to keep me honest and to give me very likely as much hell as they can fit into the 60 minutes that will probably be here, 60 minutes or less, I have Chris Cummings. How are you doing today, Chris?
Doing well, ready to raise hell, praise Dale, you know?
Oh, God, what an awful and amazing reference.
And you know, Nick, the reason it's been so long is because you're old.
No, it's not the age, Chris. It's the mileage.
Oh, yeah. Now, Andre's not old. Nick, however, is old. Yeah.
Right. Obviously. Yes, obviously. Sure. And then we also have our favorite
punching bag.
Our favorite foul-mouthed New Jersey resident, Jay Stewart.
New Jersey native. That's right. I'm doing well, since you didn't ask.
I was just getting ready to see. Always.
You're not quick enough for the New Jersey minute here.
Come on, Nick. Jay, you must not have gotten caught up in any jug handle turnoffs in New Jersey since you're in such a good mood.
Of course not. It's just me every day.
Every day, Jay.
Oh, boy. Oh, no.
Like a Twitter account.
That's going to die on the vine like a New Jersey tomato. Please don't do that.
No. Every day, Jay, that's going to be a thing. Everybody, let's hashtag some every day, Jay, on whatever hashtag social media
trademark. Absolutely not. All right.
Thank goodness social media is dead for Jay's sake.
I know. Well, is it? Whichever one you're willing to tolerate, let's make everyday Jay a thing.
LinkedIn. Just doing it on LinkedIn.
Do it on LinkedIn. No one
will hashtag New Jersey, hashtag grindset, hashtag everyday Jay.
Grindset. Oh, God. Everybody's tired of us talking already.
So let's talk about computers.
Yeah, let's talk about computering and networking. So you have this thing, Andre, and it's pretty unique. I mean, I piddled around with it a little bit. It's pretty nifty. You want to give us a high level 5,000 foot view of what this thing called Border Zero is?
Yeah. What is this thing? Yeah. So there's a bunch of stories to tell, but like high level, what is it? Border Zero is a cloud managed solution designed to streamline remote access. So think of it as access to your servers, your routers, switches, databases, or internal web applications without necessarily the need for your traditional VPN. So it's very easy to access things. For the administrator, sort of on the other side of things, that is responsible for securing your environment, Border Zero provides lots of visibility and control. And so that means you can define very easily and granularly who should have access to what resources under what conditions. And then you can also basically replay all the sessions. So you can see what's happening and who's logging into what and, you know, what queries Nick is executing on the database or what SSH commands he's executing on that router.
Drop table.
Yeah, and we can prevent you from doing that as well, actually. It goes pretty deep. But what I think is maybe interesting, because obviously you guys are network geeks and people listening to this are network geeks. One of the things I at some point thought about it is like it's like a VPN and a firewall sort of all in one and reimagined. So if you think of it as, well, I need to access this database or server or router. So normally you would jump on the VPN. And then you become part of this remote network. And, you know, that's actually problem number one, right? Because now you are part of this remote network and you basically have access to all the things, like this lateral access problem. And then on the other side, when you think of it as writing an access control rule or a firewall rule, you do something like, you know, from this IP address to that IP address on that port number. But what you're really doing is like, actually, from this IP address meant Nick's home IP address, or you know, the VPN range. So you're in your head already translating what that VPN, what that IP address really means. But what you're thinking of is identity, right? So everything should be identity first. And then the same for the destination. It's like, well, this is, I don't know, the subnet with all the servers or the database or whatever. So what you really want to say is it's the database. It's not like this IP address and this port number. And so that's what we do. That's what a modern day firewall would look like. And then similarly, if you think about the logs, you could see like flow logs. Imagine that, like source IP, destination IP, port numbers and stuff like that. In our case, you see that, but you also see a little picture next to it and you can see, oh, this is Chris accessing it. As user Ubuntu or user Cisco or whatever. So you can go a little bit deeper and then you can click on it and actually replay the session. So I guess that's like the 5,000 foot overview as well as a network version of it.
I think from the very brief bit I've played with it, I would almost describe it as guacamole plus plus, like with like way better stuff around it. And that kind of sells it short, but to me, like I've used, you know, Cloudflare Access and Google's BeyondCorp in the past, and this seems like, you know, a very similar tool in some ways. But, you know, what I really like about it that differentiates a little bit is the tunneling capabilities and all of that. So obviously we'll dive into what that means. But yeah, like it's kind of cool. You can just, you know, install, you know, a deal on your system and it dials out to border zero. And now I have access to that system through a web browser. And everything I do while I'm accessing it is audited and stuff. And, you know, I can restrict who has access to that in my border zero panel and all that stuff. So it's nice because all of those actions are tied to me and not tied, like you say, to an IP address. Cause that's like the classic VPN problem of like, okay, if somebody gets onto your VPN, like they now have access to this super trusted position. Or even if you use Bastion hosts, like if somebody roots that Bastion host, congratulations, they now have network connectivity to everything. And I've seen that happen. I mean, I'll never forget, and I'll name and shame Fortinet here, Fortinet's VPN software. I have seen it compromised so many times in my career. And I'll never forget having a pen tester one time who we'd hired call me and be like, and this was like an hour after starting the engagement. And he said, hey, it's so-and-so the pen tester. I was like, oh, hey, how's it going? Is your domain admin password this? And I was like,
mic drop.
Yeah, it was like
already.
And you know, the way he got that was because, you know, it was before a lot of these zero trust network architecture style tools existed. We were relying on a VPN and Fortinet sucks in every regard. And so like their VPN was like full of holes. They had like, you know, anyway, but all that to say is it's cool to me to see real products in this space that actually work. Because I hear people talking about zero trust all day, every day, and like so little of it do you see people actually doing stuff? Or it's like, how do I install zero trust on my network? You know, like, it's cool to complain with it. And I like the cost to get started.
Yeah, I know for sure. I definitely got some zero trust vibes out of it. It almost reminded me of, you know, because, you know, several of us have been using either Tailscale or Zero Tier or any, you know, one of the one of the mesh VPN technologies. You know, and you can do some sort of ZTA style stuff with those too, but this sort of seemed to merge and meld the, you know, the ZTA zero trust architecture concepts with that a little bit more, at least from my, you know, sort of caveman perspective of what they are, because the auditing pieces were like the, you know, first class right up front. Right. And auditing, while it's not sexy, right, it is absolutely critical and required for those types of things, right? And I agree with Chris, the cost to get started is really good. That's, you know, I logged right in and decided.
I think it's very important. Yeah, you can like you have to be able to answer the questions like who did what when, or at least who accessed what when, right? And so the problem with the VPN is, well, most people notice, especially in networking, like the castle moat model, right? Like, so we have this giant wall, and you can't penetrate the network. But there's one way in, and once you're in, you're free to go, essentially. You're on this privileged network, and just because you happen to come from this VPN range, you essentially have access to all the things. And on top of that, even though I know who connected to the VPN, in most environments, it's really hard to figure out what happened afterwards. It's like, I know Chris logged in at 9 a.m., but what he did is a bit of a mystery to me, and some apps might provide you that or some don't, but it's like all over the place. And so one of the things that's different than sort of the VPNs and even the modern day mesh VPNs is that we go higher up in the stack if you want us to. So we can go as high as layer 7 for HTTP and SSH and MySQL and Postgres, or we can keep it to essentially a per destination micro tunnel, essentially.
Yeah, I as much as it is, you know, the special Halloween episode of Modem and Snickers is the best candy, so I love a nice chocolatey outside that's hard to get into with a nougaty center. And it's not a good network design, and despite how much I love them. But I do like that you have the flexibility for organizations who are transitioning and might be more comfortable with the Snickers model, I think. You know, you can still have... it's just an IP tunnel that's like more directed and those flows are still authenticated to a user. But that you also have the application level integration for, I think, you know, people who are a bit more ready to maybe dive into these things. And it's great because you can just, once you get to the world where you don't have to connect to a VPN to do your job, it's a game changer, like for productivity. Like it's
very
really
much a game changer.
This is the problem always, like, you know, but these security solutions, like, so you typically have two choices. Like, let's imagine even for your pet project, right? So you have a DigitalOcean machine or an Amazon thing, you know, most people just hang it out on the internet. Like, I want to just SSH into it. And that's okay because, you know, the cost of getting compromised is not that big deal, like your WordPress instance or whatever, right? And you do that because it's low friction. Right. So and then in the enterprise environment, like, we need security for obvious reasons. But the way we do that is we just put more hurdles along the way. So it's harder to do. But then it's also harder for you and me to do our jobs. And then what happened is that, you know, people are smart. So they build in their own backdoors and then everything falls apart. Right. So that's why we focus both on like ease of use. Like you mentioned already. Oh, you can use your browser to access any SSH server or any database server, and we use what's called WebAssembly. And so everything, the whole client, the tunnels, everything's rendered in your browser. So that's pretty cool. And you know, one of the reasons that inspired me to build this was so I worked at OpenDNS for a while and was very successful, and then that got acquired by Cisco, and the teams were still fairly small. And so we had an environment of like, 20 engineers. And so the typical VPN issue was not that big of a deal at that point because we knew everyone and we kind of trusted everyone. And then like, we brought in more people, other people from Cisco and contractors. And before we knew it, we were like, there's 200 people with access to essentially all the things. And we were like, to be honest, I have no clue who has access to what anymore. Who is accessing what and what the heck is happening? And that's kind of like, if you could reimagine that, like there's more and more people with this problem, how would you design it? And this is our version of that.
That's a good point. Yeah. Andre, I got a question. So you talked about the replayability of watching a session happen real time, right? Of what the user entered or what they accessed. Can you drive any analytics out of there? So like if I wanted to query if anybody had written a specific command and it would go out and search across all the sessions, or is it just simply a viewable window that you could watch and try to figure out or deduce?
Yeah, you can. So basically, it depends a little bit on the pro. So we support session recording for, as long as we can go L7. So if you allow us to go that deep, we can do it for any shell-based thing. So typically SSH or container access, and then HTTP session recording as well, and databases. And so these are stored in a certain format. And so part of that format is allows us to replay it. But in the end, it's just like some kind of JSON file, for example. And so we can just textify that. And we've done a bunch of experiments with, for example, you know, if you would allow us, we could send this to OpenAI and we could send you summaries of what happened. And we could ask questions. Hey, this was Chris or Jay logging into to the database. Can you give me a quick summary of what happened? And if you would rate it from 1 to 10 on security, how high is it? And if it's higher than a certain number, I should probably send an email to Nick because Jay is fucking around again.
I was going to say the McKinsey consultants are going to love this. You know, Jay was 20% productive today. You should drop his bonus, you know?
Jay only uses the up arrow in the terminal. Let's give him a smaller keyboard.
Yeah, you just know those keys. Spaces, not tabs.
Yeah. Jay spent so much time looking up Chicago deep dish pizza. Like he's was looking for something better than what is available near where he lives in New Jersey.
Yeah, Jay was using the Lynx browser, the Lynx web browzer to go on Zillow.
He installed Lynx and then was doing
great.
But the other cool thing is like, so you, this is, these are all like, because it's like, you know, all this stuff is developed over the last 2 years or so. So it's like done in a modern way. So you can request everything using APIs, including the session recordings. And so one of the cool things is you could build your own analytics engine on top of that and like, you know, search for whatever you think is relevant in your environment, send that to your SIM, and maybe something gets flagged. And because everything's API driven, you can basically send an API request and say, hey, kill this session. And we can immediately in real time kill the sessions as well. So there's a lot of cool things you can do. Either we can do directly or for users to build their own integrations with fully open RESTful API.
So one thing you mentioned about the tech stack was you mentioned WASM. I'm curious about that because WebAssembly has always been one of those things that I have found really intriguing because it's incredibly powerful. And like at first glance, I'm like, you want to do what in a browser? And it like makes me shudder. But then like, as I learned about it, I was like, oh, that's really cool. And then being a crustacean that I am, learning about Rust and Rust and WebAssembly and how that all can work and how you can write stuff in Rust and WebAssembly, I got to ask, are you using Rust in here?
No, it's all written in Go. I think almost everything is written in Go, including the WebAssembly code and then compiled to WebAssembly.
That's cool.
And I mean, that actually all started. So typically, we call it Innovation Friday, where we're like, because we're mostly a bunch of geeks trying to build cool tools and reimagining it. And part of that is innovation. And so mostly every Friday, we're like, okay, let's innovate, or basically let's fuck around and you know, experiment. Yeah. And it started with, hey, I hear WASM is cool. Let's write a hello world. And then the next Friday is like, you know, made a more advanced version and more. And like a few weeks in, we had a much better understanding of the stack. And then one day we did a hackathon and we were like, oh my God, this can actually just work. It's going to be amazing. And I will also say, like probably like you, I consider myself a bit of a CLI junkie. Like, you know, don't give me all this stuff. But nowadays, I use more and more the web interface because, you know, one of the nice things is when you log in, you get to discover, like some of you may have seen these Okta tiles. This is kind of what this is inspired in. You log in, you get to see exactly what you have access to, like which servers, and it's nicely grouped together. And I just click on it and it's done. And especially in the modern way where, or the modern day where a lot of our infrastructure is ephemeral, service come and go and scale up and down, it's pretty hard to remember all the names. And so I find myself using it more and more against my own expectations. So yeah, it's pretty cool.
Well, the other thing I like too is, so you recently did a blog post on using this for GitHub Actions so that you could have access to basically, you know, the CI pipelines that you might be running for code. And now that you don't have to just do it for that, but that kind of showcased some of the things that you can do. So you could set up like a webhook from Border Zero to, you know, call back to Slack and notify you when something happens and then give you the information about like, here's the session to go see this. So like from an operational standpoint, I really like the idea that I could write in my application, you know, points where maybe somebody needs to go in and, you know, unfuck something, right? We still have some process that has to happen by hand. And, you know, you could have all that happen kind of through here. You know, you could, you know, have your code be like, okay, fire off an alert and then open up a socket out to Border Zero so that, you know, somebody can troubleshoot it and then throw all that into a ticket to your, you know, on calls and, you know, your people who need to do stuff. Like that is pretty cool. And the other thing that also popped in my mind with all this was like remote vendor access. So that's something that's always really tough in organizations, especially when you're stuck on a VPN model, you know, so being able to give There was a tool, I forget what it was called, that I used at a former job that was like, it was all on-prem and it was a real pain in the butt to use. But like the whole point was your vendors could log into this thing and then they could ask for on-demand access to a resource. Mm-hmm. Then you would get an email that says like, hey, vendor so-and-so wants access to work on, you know, whatever the message was. And then you could like grant, deny, you know, click those buttons. So I could see like this being used for very similar things, right? As a organization that has to work with consultants, you know, especially when you have like long-term consultants that need remote access, but you don't want them having permanent access at the same level as staff, like being able to do really granular stuff. And I wanted to ask too, one other thing you mentioned was that you can write a lot of like security policies around this. And I'd be really interested to hear more about some of those, especially like, can I write security policies around like what people can do on the command line or what like issue, like commands they can issue or database, like SQL commands, if you have a database connector or things like that.
Yeah. Oh, there's a lot to unpack there. But yeah, real quick. Yeah. That, I think the GitHub Actions is a great example of a simple integration. Like, hey, this thing failed, automatically create a socket, send out the notification, click here. And now you have 15 minutes to go troubleshoot it. And then similarly, what you mentioned with contractor access or vendor access, this was the exact problem I mentioned earlier that we saw at, you know, when we were at Cisco earlier, where we just had a contractor come in, say, for 2 weeks to do the very specific task. And then what I had to remember was like 2 weeks ahead of time, I had to create a ticket with IT. They would give that person AD credentials so they'd get on the VPN. But obviously, we tried to integrate almost everything with SSO. So now this person was on the VPN, could wander around, and had SSO creds. So, you know, was, oh, another wiki. I wonder what's in here. And it typically all just worked. And so I think that's just one of the things to just go in more and more granular. And so, yeah, granular access control is a big part. So we have what we call our policies. And the policies allow you to define, first of all, who. So what identity. So we integrate with your existing single sign-on credentials and by default, Google or GitHub or Azure or your own SSO provider. And then you can say what countries. So you can make a filter like that. Or a lot of people want to explicitly disallow countries because of laws or whatever. And then you know time and date range stuff too. That's all the stuff we do by default. And then in addition, you can we have integrations with PagerDuty. That's pretty cool. You say, actually, Chris can only access the prod database if he is on call. Otherwise, someone else will need to approve it first or something. So we have these API integrations with them.
That's cool. Very cool. That's really neat.
Yeah.
The vendor integration stuff is really what came to mind when I started playing around with this because, you know, there's – and actually, this is going to lead into my next question. One of the things that, as Chris mentioned, is hard to do, and you mentioned it too, is just you have vendors, they have a, you know, you have some sort of contractual agreement with them. They need to get in and do things. You don't necessarily want to have to supervise them. Maybe you do, maybe you don't, but you want the ability to see what they've done and to revoke access at any time. This seems to be able to allow that. So in conjunction with that, what two-factor authentication mechanisms are available? Because that's often one of the requirements of a zero trust architecture that, you know, sort of goes along with it hand in glove. Mm-hmm. Well, you also have to have some sort of multi-factor authentication that's required along with that.
Yeah, so I think that's, I would say twofold. So first of all, we try to integrate with people's existing single sign-on providers. So you don't necessarily have to create users in our system as well, because everything has to be identity first. So most of that we rely on like your identity provider having MFA and so on and so forth. Now, one of the interesting things what our policies do allow is kind of reach out to an external service. So we talked about PagerDuty as sort of a native integration, but we also have, think of it as a webhook integration. So basically saying, hey, Nick is trying to access something and then call this webhook. And then you define the URL, and we will call that URL. And then you basically need to reply with thumbs up, thumbs down, and a set of actions. But you can build that code yourself. And so it could be as easy as a random number generator, or depending on the weather or whatever. But what the more useful use cases are, I want to integrate with a system internally to me, let's say at ESNet, where we can't easily integrate with because it's in a private infrastructure, or you just don't want us to give access. So what you do is basically you get that request and you say, oh, this request is Nick trying to access the core router in Chicago or whatever. And then you can do your own business logic, and maybe it looks up, did Chris complete his security training? Is Chris on PTO? You can make your own logic, could be 10 lines, could be a million lines, and then you just say yes or no. And so that's how we allow for integrations, and that potentially could, for example, be an MFA-like integration. Okay. And the thing that we return is a thumbs up and down and an action. And the action basically means, what is Nick allowed to do? And that's kind of maybe what Chris was asking earlier, right?
Not much.
Certainly not drop the table. but like, for example, the policy says exactly, hey, these types of database queries are allowed. And it's pretty basic right now. We say, hey, you can do basically the first keyword, right? Select, drop, describe, and you can do that. And that's pretty decent. But that's where we'll focus more and more. And the same for SSHs. That's where we'll do a lot more, basically start building these layer 7 firewalls.
Yeah, I did notice when I set it up, like it relied on, just for access, right? I have Google app, Google Apps or whatever it's called nowadays, G Suite. I just set up my account with that. And since I require multi-factor authentication on that, my MFA is however I set it up with my identity provider, which, as I said, happens to be Google. So that's kind of nice. Because that is something that is often required, but it's also pretty cool that you can sort of drill down and make it even more granular based on whatever your rules. How complicated do you want to make the rules, basically,
It's really cool. I find. Like, I was super excited about it, mostly from a geek level. It's like building my own. There's actually a blog, like kind of tongue-in-cheek, called The Most Flexible Policy Engine in the World. Because, you get a lot of questions. Can you do this? Can you do that? And, well, it sounds kind of cool, but it sounds very unique to you, or we don't have access to that data that lives in your world. And so we're like, well, why don't we just send you the question and then you can reply and you can build really cool stuff.
Very cool. Very cool. So how long, this has been around for what, at least a year, right?
Like yes. So we started the company 2 years ago, and then because there's a lot of technical work involved building a lot of this stuff. So basically, you have to build a VPN alternative, so a bunch of tunneling. I have to build proxy servers, and not just like an HTTP proxy server, because you can just get them off the shelf, right? You just use Nginx or whatever. No, we decided that we wanted an SSH proxy server. Like, what the fuck is that, right? Can I say that? Anyways, or now I want a MySQL and a Postgres database proxy server. And you're like, oh, that's not actually really a thing. And there's no Nginx version of that. So we built all that stuff ourselves. And so that's a lot of intellectual property. And then we host all of that as a service, and then the tunneling and the recording and stuff like that. The fun part is I've learned a ton about these protocols. So what I still am amazed by is SSHs. So I've been sort of doing this for 20 years, like you guys. And SSHs has been, I remember sort of transition from Telnet to SSH. And so I've been using SSHs for 2 decades, essentially, as a user. And, I know some of the flags, the port forwarding and stuff like that. And if you start implementing your own clients and your own proxy, you have to really understand the protocol. And I've been sort of in awe and feel sometimes I need to stand up for SSHs, because it's a very magical protocol. I feel like things like HTTP2 and HTTP3 and QUIC get a lot of credit, but SSHs has done a lot of the same things. It has all these, basically you set up an authenticated TCP session, right? Keys or passwords. And at the base, all you have is an encrypted authenticated channel. And then you can start up a new streams, as Quick would call it, and one is a stream of shell, and one is port forwarding, one secure copy, and whatever. And you do multiple in parallel too, which is really interesting. You can have 5 shell sessions over the same TCP thing, And so that's as a geek, I've been very excited about learning that.
The fact that you can like use a SOX proxy over SSH, like, and you can proxy literally all of your web traffic through a certain host, yep, and use that with like the proxy jump kind of directive. And then the fact that you can nest all of that together, I truly think if I was stuck on a desert island and I could only bring one protocol with me, it would be SSH. Like, you can do everything with it. There's nothing you can't do.
And it doesn't get the credit that it deserves. Everybody thinks that it's, oh yeah, you're just like go over there and use VI and go away, right?
Yeah.
But SSH is very underappreciated. I remember when OpenSSH became a thing, like I was a very heavy OpenBSD user, and they said, well, this SSH just doesn't cut it, right? You know, you won't address these problems. We're gonna build our own. And there was a whole big to-do about, you know, oh, now there's two, right? And obviously, clearly one of them has won out, right? OpenSSH is the de facto standard on almost everything, right?
Yeah.
But like all of the bits and pieces that go along with it are very underappreciated and honestly not very well understood. Like when I was at the Supercomputing Center, we found out that a bunch of these researchers were SCPing their data around, right? And so this is 20 years ago. We had put these very bleeding edge 10 gig and OC192 connections across the country, right? It was a very big deal. Like you got national news and stuff, and they're SCPing stuff around and they're going, why did we build this? The performance is terrible. Like they didn't understand, like you can change the cipher, you can change this. Oh, by the way, SSH also has its own windowing mechanism built into it that you have to understand. So it's like the fact that that's been re-implemented and you've got this in there and you can do all those things with it is really, I mean, you did it in 2 years. And that's pretty impressive.
Yeah. Maybe back to your timeline. So I think the first I left Cisco in, I think, was it 2021, I guess, or 20? I don't remember, something like that. And then we talked a little bit earlier, I started this project called MySocket, which is kind of how it started. But really was a project for me to, well, twofold. I wanted to learn more Go. It's like I said, everything is written in Go. The other one was I had this sort of, well, now I want to learn more Go or whatever programming language, Rust, you kind of need to have a project because otherwise you're doing just the puzzles, which is not fun, right? And so at the same time, I had this problem in mind, what we alluded to earlier with like this remote access, and it's just a mess. But it's also the status quo. And that's kind of how it started. It's like, oh, I wonder how do you build a tunneling mechanism using maybe just SSL tunnels or something like that. And that was really remarkable. The Go programming language is so powerful. So that, you know, you can actually build an SSH proxy or a MySQL proxy, something that would be a lot harder in, for example, Python, which is what I used a lot before, even if it's just because of the performance. So I fiddled around with that for a while, and that eventually became Border Zero. We're with six people now. We have folks here in Canada, in Brazil, and in the Netherlands as well. So we're a global company.
Very cool. Yeah, I've been trying to set this podcast up for, well, I think I created my account in like June, fiddled around with it for a while. I'm like, we should do this. And then, you know, travel and summer. And
well, yeah, we actually originally
here for like two straight months. And so we just couldn't get it scheduled.
Yeah.
We wanted to originally schedule this to talk about MySocket.
That's right.
Way back when. I think that was like, we had tried to schedule this, I think probably as like modem episode number 2 or something like that. It was pretty
weird. That's right. And I forgot about that.
Never got around to it because, you know, turns out we're actually terrible at running this thing. But but maybe you want to talk a little bit more about MySocket a bit, because that is a big underpinning of this thing, right?
Yeah. So that was sort of, I think MySocket was kind of two things. So one, I was kind of just experimenting, and one of them was like any cost as a service. That was a big thing for MySocket as well. Like, so I had these TCP services, and so I really enjoyed working with Anycast sort of in a previous life. And then services like Global Accelerator on AWS came out and a few others. And I was like, oh, that's really cool. But I think you can build a better version of it. And so that's what we tried to do. So that was the underpinning, sort of the everything is Anycasted. Everything you can build basically either a TCP proxy or go higher up in the stack, and we start adding up more and more of these layer 7 services. And then more recently, we've really moved into, part of the problem is it's a very technical product. And if you want to move away from sort of the status quo, you have to have a lot of incentive, right? Like either you really, we had a security incident and we have to figure out how to do it differently, but we also want to make it really easy. And so, how do you deploy something like this? And one of the things I really remember at Cisco was the Meraki model. Like I'm sure you've all used and seen Merakis. And, it's pretty cool. Like you just basically rack the thing, it dials in, and you configure the whole thing from the portal. And so we have a similar model now where, you install that connector, which is literally a Go binary. It installs itself as a service, it dials home, and then you can basically attach services to it. And the really cool part is it comes with discovery plugins as well. And so you can say, if you run it in AWS environment, for example, say, hey, go and find all my EC2 instances, and it will show up, and then you can automatically turn them into services. And that's really, made for the ephemeral nature of more and more of these modern environments where you can just quickly create them. You don't even have to click on it. You can also use SDKs, Terraform, different ways. But yeah, going back to MySocket, it's all based on, I want to build something any cost as a service. And the problem to be solved is remote access, because I think that's ripe to be done better.
Yeah, the zero trust model especially, I think, is very ripe.
So that was part of the challenge. There was like, okay, yeah, zero trust, yeah, we should do zero trust. And then you're like, I remember reading days and days and like, okay, but what is zero trust? Like, how do I make sure this is zero trust? And then a lot of different people have different views on it, but for me, there's a few sort of pillars, like never trust, always verify, least privilege, micro segmentation, limit the blast radius, continuous enforcement and authorization. And so we took all those things, and I think the big thing is just micro segmentation and least privilege, right? That's just a huge problem with the traditional setups.
Yeah, so, I think your assessment there of what the ZTA stuff, I mean, if you can define ZTA, then
right. Not if you could define it, except you could sell it, right? Isn't that what?
Well, sure, but the fact that the things that you've rattled off are things that I've heard in the periphery, of ZTA as those are the things, the pillars that people are looking for. Pillars is the terminology, right? So you've got that right out of the gate. But like
I'm looking for pillars of salt only. So, well, I'm curious, on the topic of zero trust, it does sound like I would have to trust Border Zero quite a bit with this kind of access into my network, right? So that's not necessarily a bad thing, because I'm of the view that you're always trusting vendors, regardless of whether or not they have direct access or they're putting hardware in your network or whatever. Like, you are trusting vendors. But there are steps, obviously, that would need to be taken as an organization if I was evaluating this and wanting to go down the path of using Border Zero as my, zero trust access solution for certain things or for everything. So what kind of stuff on the Border Zero side is done to make sure that this isn't just, Fortinet firewalls with default passwords?
Yeah. That's fair. So one of the things are, everything is end-to-end encrypted. So we don't actually see your traffic. So from the client to what we call the connector that runs in your environment, there is an encrypted tunnel there. So we can't see anything in the middle. Now there sits something in the middle. There's a proxy that we own, and that is basically a, think of it as an MTLS proxy. So basically, because one of the big benefits is you can't think of it as a Raspberry Pi at home that sits behind NAT, and you want to make that available. Well, you have this NAT punching problem, right? So what we do is this thing dials out to our infrastructure, registers itself with all the certificates and all that kind of stuff, and then someone comes in from the other side that wants to access it. We authenticate it. It's like, hey, is this really Chris? Does Chris have access to this thing? Then we stitch these two connections together, and through that, they set up a new TLS connection that authenticates again towards the connector. And so we can't see anything. From there on, if you do enable session recording, that session recording happens in the connector. And then is uploaded to our system so that you can replay it, and they're stored, encrypted in S3 and all that kind of good stuff. So that's a big plus, right? Like, as long as we can't see your traffic, we can't do much with it. Then there's all kinds of things taken care of in terms of, especially the upstream connectivity. So you have the connector. So the client connects, eventually ends up on the connector that runs in your environment. And now you want to connect to, say, a database or an SSH server or an EC2 instance. Now that connector essentially acts as a full L7 proxy. Now, the benefit of that, it can do full credential brokering. So, for example, if you have recently connected to your database or something, like, I'm not sure you use databases, but typically, hey, I need to create a table or something or modify something. Chris goes to his whatever database guy in the team, like, hey, what are the credentials? And he'll probably say something, oh, yeah, go to LastPass or OnePass, you know, and that's where DB admin thing is. And so I can also probably guarantee you that password hasn't been rotated in the last 5 years, right? Because it's scary and used in all kinds of places. So there's a real problem with shared credentials. But what would be better if Chris never had access to that password? It's not like you want it, like you just need it. So what we do is we on the fly set up that connection on behalf of Chris. Only the connector has access to these credentials. And there's different ways we do, for example, integrate with different secrets manager, Amazon secrets manager, parameter store, environment variables, etc. So those we want you to keep those credentials as well. But the big benefit is that you can now log in using just your single sign-on credential to the database. You'll never get asked for a password. And similarly for upstream SSH servers, you can specify a password or username in the connector using external secrets manager or keys or whatever. And better, especially, we're aiming quite a bit of Amazon right now. Amazon has all kinds of ways for you to connect to a container or a EC2 instance. It's called EC2 Instance Connect or Session Manager. And we actually implemented those protocols. And that means that we don't need any credentials at all. As long as this machine has the right role, it can go there. And so we're looking really, really hard to eliminate the need for secrets anywhere. And certainly don't expose them to end users so that, we're all humans and, you know, might copy paste this in the wrong place, or I hate accessing the secret manager, so I'll keep it in my own text file or whatever. Mm. These things happen.
So, yeah, that's pretty cool. That makes sense. And, you know, I could see you even by doing that, you'd be forcing, I think, your organization to perhaps use better secret management as well. If you integrated with something like, you know, Vault or like HashiVault, right?
Exactly. For example.
You could have those passwords automatically rotated now that they're in there and all that stuff too.
So the nice thing about this is it's not only easier for you to use, it's actually also more secure and less people have access to it. So yeah, obviously I'm excited about this. To me, this is all a no-brainer. You should just use it.
I get that for sure. The other concern I think people might have around something like this, aside from, you know, the elevated trust I think you have to give an external organization, which again, like I think is kind of just a fair thing, is, you know, availability to your critical infrastructure too. So you've talked a little bit about how, you know, you've mentioned the magical word that makes me happy, Anycast. Yeah. You know, that's cool. That gets me excited. Like what kind of stuff's going on like in the back end? Like how, cause this is, to me, this is like, you know, a cloud service provider offering, right? So it's kind of cool to get to peek behind the curtain of, you know, how that's being run actually run operationally.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, so we have a bunch of, so we're built on Amazon, and I am, like you, a big Anycast geek, so I love it. So that was basically, doesn't matter what we're building, it has to be Anycasted. And so that's how this started with MySocket. So fully Anycasted, we're currently in 7 or 8 regions around the world. So basically covering all the major, like Asia, Europe, North America. And then we have compute in all of those regions. So the nice thing about, we're using AWS Global Accelerator, which is like, I don't know, 200 POPs or so, something worldwide. So we ingest the traffic really quick. It goes onto Amazon's backbone, which is, you know, a lot better than the regular internet. And then it goes to the closest server, which will be in any of those 7 or 8 locations. And then from there on, we own the traffic and we can send it to wherever it needs to go. So let's say the server that you're trying to access is in Tokyo or something like that. Then we send it from wherever you ended up on our infrastructure to that Tokyo server. And so all of that, again, is encrypted. So it goes over the Amazon backbone, but we also have our own encrypted overlay on top of that. yeah, we try and actually do a lot of middle mile optimization as well, trying to figure out which one is best. And you can also have this connector can have multiple connections to, for example, multiple upstream servers. So yeah, I think availability is very important to us. And it, like you, that's kind of in my blood. Like I'm like an infrastructure and operator kind of guy. So we have very detailed instructions. Like every now and then, a Amazon region goes wonky. What do we do? Well, here is the process to take a site out of rotation. And you know, that's just this, because it's any cost that everything will just automatically reroute. And most of that's just taken care of it by itself. If we run out of capacity, we can just spin up more computers or servers in those regions. And so everything scales very nicely horizontally and fails over really nicely. And so that's been really cool. And that's kind of how it works under the cover infrastructure-wise. Any cost is awesome.
Yeah, it sounds like a lot of thoughts got into that. I'm curious, do you guys use Border Zero for a lot of management of Border Zero itself? How does that chicken egg scenario work?
Yeah.
I feel like it might be hard to do that, but maybe you have like a separate instance or something. Or...
Yeah, no. Well, since we're a startup, like we have to eat our own dog food or, you know, dog steaks. So yeah, we use it every day. And this is how we learn a lot. We are power users of Amazon ourselves. So we drive a lot of that. So accessing the RDS databases, the servers, the containers goes through our own infrastructure. Obviously, we have break glass scenarios to deal with that. But generally, luckily, we haven't had to use that much. Since we're basically a power user ourselves, when something doesn't work, we're like, well, I would never want to use it if it's like this. So let's improve that. And a lot of the kinks have been worked out. The hard part's like always like... how do you deal with what we call blue-green deployments? There's a new version of the proxy server. How do we do that? So we use blue-green deployments where we spin up sort of new servers in those new regions, let them run in parallel and bleed, wait for most of the sessions to be timed out. All the new ones will go to the new servers, and then eventually you pull the plug on the old ones. And then most of that traffic bleeds over seamlessly. It really depends on how long you let them run. All that stuff, yeah, we're pretty proud of it. That's pretty smooth. Lots of Grafana dashboards, what's going on. I think we had one, it's actually interesting. So we have a tool, it's called BTT, and it's called the Border Zero testing tool. It's an internal tool, which we run essentially constantly from all location. It's trying to create what we call a new service or a new socket, say a new SSH socket. It will create it using the API. It will then try and log into it, see if the session shows up in the session log, terminate that session, and then stop. So it's a full sort of integration end-to-end test. It does that for all locations. It does it for all the service types that we have, like MySQL, Postgres, HTTP, SSH. And it does that for all locations constantly. So basically what that means is that we're generating thousands of sessions an hour. And at times, it's basically a real power user slash DDoS. And at times, it's been a bit of a problem on our end. And so we had to do some special things. We use Auth0 for authentication on the back end. And they started rate limiting that kind of stuff. And so it's been a real sort of pressure tester for us. And that's why we're pretty confident if someone come and say, hey, I have 1,000 users that log in once a minute. It's like, oh, sure. We already have one like that. No problem.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, it's good to hear that, like, you know, you're dog fooding in and that, you know, you're actually testing it and being power users of it yourself, because I can't tell you how many tools I've used that, you know, and you can probably hear my cat in the background here, but how many tools I've used that you can just tell the people who wrote it don't use it, and it's just full of just hard to use stuff. Yeah. And like one thing I even noticed that really showed that to me was if anybody listening tries this, you sign up for the free account, which gives you like 5 connections or 10 connections, something like that. And there, it immediately drops you into a wizard, which is great about setting up like your first connector. But if you're like me, I'm like, oh, I don't actually want to set this up now. And so I stopped, I went away, and now I clicked the, like, I'll do that later. I just want to see the dashboard. I want to see the shiny. And I started poking around, and then there's a nice little banner at the top that was like, do you want to resume the get started workflow? I was like, oh my goodness. Like, yes, because I still wanted to do it. I just didn't want to do it then because I have ADD and I wanted a dopamine rush. I didn't want to have to do work. So yeah, you can tell there's a lot of gems like that of people that have actually used it and tried it out.
Yeah, even that's being improved now. I think as of maybe tomorrow, there will be standard sandbox servers in your account. So you can we spin up a connector for you in our environment, but it's fully yours. So you can, yeah, just to lower that friction of getting going. And one thing, maybe back to the Anycast part, as we're all Anycast geeks, there's a blog actually. Because I said, you know what, not only is what we're doing obviously more secure and lower friction for users, I think it's also faster because of the Anycast nature. And so imagine a use case where you have servers and infrastructure all around the world and you're visiting from whatever, Chicago or wherever you are in Vancouver here, and you need to access something on the other side of the world. That goes over the internet. And as you all well know, like sometimes the internet performs, sometimes it doesn't. Certain locations are like in, you know, more difficult locations. And so we actually put that to the test and we built what we call, you can actually go there, speedtest.border0.io, where you can see, you go request basically a 1 meg file from that particular region directly over the internet and through our Anycast infrastructure. And then it will show you how much time you saved. And so generally, and especially if you're on poor internet connectivity, you'll save like 10, 20% or something, which also means it will be faster. And so that wasn't necessarily the big intent, but the cool part is like all of that you just get for free. Like you just get optimized routing, middle mile optimization, high availability, all that kind of cool stuff.
Yeah, that's really like cool. A lot of stuff that comes great with Anycast, but like Chris said earlier, I think that it's really clear when you go to use it that, like, at least to me, when I was playing around with it and using it, I was like, this is a tool that was built by somebody who knew what they wanted to do and they probably use it themselves. I mean, I knew it was you, so I kind of knew, like, you're going to build a tool that you want to use, mm-hmm. right? You're not going to build a tool that you hate and try to use it, right? But like just the care that's put into the little things like the bandwidth testing and, you know, the Anycast pieces that make sure that, you know, you always have something topologically close to you. And for the users or the users, the listeners that maybe don't have a great understanding of what Anycast is, an example of Anycast that you probably see every day is the 1.1.1.1. DNS is very often an Anycast service. It's sort of like the hello world of Anycast, right? So 1.1.1.1, the Google Quad 8s, those are all Anycast. That's not just like a server sitting somewhere on Cloudflare's network. It's probably a couple hundred servers sitting all over the world that are all using the same address. And then that's announced locally, which means it's the shortest, you know, the longest prefix match, so it's topologically closest, so you always get good performance.
Yeah,
and just to prove that out, I ran a speed test on speedtest.border0.io, and border0 is 1.08 times faster for me than using the internet, which saves me 0.69 nice seconds.
There you go. Cool.
I didn't make that up. That's a real test.
So yeah, that's cool.
I'd love to see, Andre, I don't know if you know fly.io as a service.
Yep,
I'd love to see if we could have border0 work with fly.io and sort of like a global Anycast but private usage of the micro VMs they run. That'd be kind of cool. But I think maybe you could detail into a little bit of like who the perfect user is of border0. Is it sort of devs that need to connect to resources all over the world? Okay.
Yeah, no, certainly. It's interesting. So we're aiming a lot and working a lot with developers, engineers, you know, folks like yourself, and also really the DevOps folks, AWS, Google, GCP environments, AWS environments that need access to their servers there. And, you know, ideally do it in a modern way. So these users could be companies that that may have just had a security incident and all of a sudden security becomes a priority, or they just raise their Series A and the security requirements go higher. So they have some kind of force that is pushing them towards like, yeah, we gotta reimagine what we're doing. We can no longer just have a bastion host or no VPNs or, you know, whitelist a bunch of IP addresses. That doesn't work anymore. So it's really in that space, people are getting a little bit more serious about security. And then the users are typically the engineers, the developer folks that need access to this infrastructure. And then on the other side, you have what we more call like the buyers, like whose problem you're solving is the security people, right? Or the VP of engineering, or like someone's who is its responsibility to make sure that they have their shit in order, essentially. Whether that's for compliance or, you know, nobody wants to get owned or have some kind of incident. And so there's some kind of force driving them. So there's sort of the two folks, like there's the actual end users. For them, we just want to make it better than what they have today, or at least as good, so that we don't create additional friction. And then for the folks responsible for the infrastructure, the security folks, we want to give them lots of visibility and control, much more than they have today. So that's one sort of segment. And then we also have seen people using it quite a bit for IoT use cases. So think about people that have stuff in like building management type stuff, or stuff that you bring into the field, you know, maybe military type use cases or whatever. Like all of a sudden, like we're not selling to the military, but it's that kind of use cases where you have a suitcase with something, some device, some radar, whatever, and it needs to dial back home, or it needs to connect. You need to connect to it for management purposes. Now, these things tend to run on LTE. And, you know, LTE is all behind carrier grade NAT. So you have that same problem. So they then are faced with, oh, we have to build our own VPNs. Or then they discover this, like, oh, I can just drop this little agent in here and it registers and I have full access and I have all this, you know, visibility and control. So those are kind of the two things that we see folks using it with. And I think we spent a lot of time on the developer use cases, integrating with AWS and DigitalOcean and GCP to really reduce that friction, make it truly passwordless, stuff like that.
So I want to ask one more question, at least for me, since you mentioned carrier grade NAT. How are we on V6? Because I did notice that the speed test page is at least V4 only.
Yeah, I was afraid you were going to bring this up. I figured it would come from Nick, since he's always talking about V6. But this is... it's going to be solved, I promise you, because I am a V6 guy too. Well, I actually used to be. I kind of given up on it, I guess. But
I don't say that.
Well, actually,
it hasn't given up on you.
We still believe in you. This is mostly because Global Accelerator didn't support IPv6, but they did roll this out, I think, last year, and so it's time for us to enable that feature, and then we should just have it. But yeah. It's funny, Nick, I was listening to your podcast the other day about something about, what was it, IPv6 source address selection, and I think you spent a lot of time on that. It's reminded me 20 years ago or so, when I graduated, my thesis was on IPv6 and IPv6 multi-homing. And, you know, back then I was like, you know, I'm going to come out of school. I am the IPv6 expert. IPv6 is going to take off, and, you know, my career is set. And then, you know, 20 years later, we're still like, oh, your stuff doesn't do IPv6. Well, it's because Amazon doesn't really do it yet. So.
Yeah, I figured there was just one component or one or two components in there, because I know you well enough to know that, like, you wouldn't leave that out. Like, you wouldn't ignore it. Like, if it's there, you'll do it.
Yes, exactly.
But yeah, I tried it. Like, usually it's me, but luckily sometimes it's Chris. It's not always me. But I do think that... you know, I had a very similar experience. You know, I'm probably a little bit older, but like 2002-ish is when I started doing a lot of V6 work. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I'm going to learn everything there is to know about this, and then I'm set, right? 20 years later, first of all, V6 multi-homing, still a shit show. Like, we wrote an IETF draft that details out, like, here are your options. Basically, if you want to do it right, if you want to do it, your only option is BGP.
And we have a good podcast episode on exactly that topic with
Ed, do have a good podcast, and I did one on IPv6 Buzz, which is, you know, similar to that on the same topic. But yeah, I figured that if there was a technical limitation that was preventing you from making it V6, and I know that when it's available, it'll work.
Yeah, Amazon does seem to be getting their shit together. Like, Google has had it a bit more together, but not entirely together than Amazon has on the V6 front. But yeah, I mean, you know, especially with IoT though, I could see, you know, there a lot of those networks are actually some of the earlier ones now, the new IoT deployments, not like your legacy ones, but like those are really going V6 only and stuff like that.
Now you can see a lot. Amazon is definitely making a push, lots of announcements now. And well, I guess mostly because they're starting to charge.
The V4.
Yeah. Right.
Exactly.
Yep. Well, let us know when you want us to test that, because we will.
Yeah, no, like, I will. This is a good reminder to put this back on the priority list. And I should also re-clarify, like, all the cool stuff that that we've built is, there's certainly over the last 2 years, a lot of cool stuff. And that's certainly not just me. Like, we have a very talented team. I kind of come up with crazy ideas, and then they tell me if it's viable or not. So I can't take all the credit.
That's a good place to be.
Yeah.
These two guys are always telling me my ideas are terrible. So.
No, it's just that you're terrible. Your ideas are actually good. It's just that you're involved.
I am awful. Like, just the worst. We're coming up on an hour. We should probably wrap it up. People will love hearing Andre and maybe Jay, but they definitely hate hearing Chris and I at this point.
I hate hearing it and all the voices in my head.
None of the voices in my head speak English, so I'm usually pretty good.
Not Italian?
No, well, sometimes it's Latin.
How can you see the hands?
Nosferatu.
Indeed. So, Andre, if they're, you know, obviously you've got your Border Zero website, but if people on the internet want to know more about this, if they want to get a hold of you, how do they do that?
Yeah, you can find me on LinkedIn. Just search for my name, or Twitter at atunk, ATOONK, borderzero.com, tunk.io. I mean, there's a lot of places you can find me. But yeah, mostly on Twitter. And yeah, go and find me and hit me up. If you like networking stuff, I do still every now and then blog on tunk.io for networking related stuff. All the other stuff goes to borderzero.com.
Awesome. Very cool. And Chris, where can people find you?
Man, you can find me out in the woods. That's about it these days. But I'm still on X, formerly known as Twitter. Skeeting on Mastodon, is that what they call it? Or is that on Blue Sky? Blue Sky, they call it a skeet. And it's so bad. Skeet, skeet, skeet.
It's better than tooting. Blue Sky.
And I am on Mastodon. All usernames are at CrankyNetMan. For Mastodon, it's at CrankyNetMan.dial.modem.show. And you can find my blog, /64.tech. And yeah.
Cool. Jay, how about you?
Somehow still on X/Twitter, at @frame_changer, or on LinkedIn with the custom URL of Network Engineer Stewart that I made when I was 14 years old. Other than that, probably on ChatGPT.
For the record, I don't talk about skeeting on LinkedIn. That's only for Twitter.
Until now.
It's getting professional.
The entirely liquid offering of what is social media nowadays. And for those that don't know that reference, I'm talking about diarrhea. So you can find me maybe on X, Twitter, Forwarding Plane, Mastodon, Forwarding Plane at dial.modem.show, LinkedIn, which I never really look at. I'm around. If you want to find me, I'm sure you can. You probably don't want to. So either way, such is life. Thanks for listening. Tune in. Rate us or don't. Either way, thanks.
Thank you for tuning into the Modem Podcast, where yesterday's modems are today's transponders. For more information or to request a topic, please visit modem.show.